Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have IQ Al Rasuli with us for the next 30 minutes. We're going to talk about the effect, the consequence of Islam in a variety of different places around the world. IQ, welcome to Shattering Myths. Good to have you back.
Thank you for having me again.
The first thing I want to mention is probably something that most people have just ignored, but there is a considerable concern that the Qatari government is treating the workers who are building the sites necessary for the World Cup, of treating their workers as slaves. 44 workers, for example, died in June and July of this year building these World Cup sites, and that most of the workers claim that they haven't been paid for months, their passports have been detained, and that they're nothing now but slaves. Is that possible in this uber-rich country like Qatar, where the members of the royal family and most of the citizens of Qatar are lavished with so much money that they'll buy a new Ferrari and run it until it runs out of gas and just leave it off to the side of the road? Is it possible that they could be treating the workers like they're slaves?
Why is America or Americans surprised? The same was being treated in Saudi Arabia for 40 years now, since the oil boom. Every human being in the sight of Islam, especially Arabic Islam, who is not a Muslim, is a beast. Who said so? Allah said so. Al-Anfal, chapter 855. For the worst of beasts in the sight of Allah are those who reject him, they will not believe. La yu'minuna means people who are not Muslim. Why is everybody shocked all of a sudden? It is a fact. They treat these people like animals. In fact, I retract. They treat their animals better than they treat these human beings.
Well, with exception of dogs, because Muhammad hated dogs, so they torture dogs.
It's
one of the problems of American servicemen in Afghanistan has been the witnessing of the Afghanis torturing dogs. They do it for giggles. So they don't really treat animals very well, but they certainly treat non-Muslims worse. This is not just in Qatar, though, which is a fabulously wealthy fiefdom. But you mentioned also in Saudi Arabia. I've read probably 50 reports out of Saudi Arabia where women are brought in from places like Kenya. They're offered salaries and the like for a two-year stint. Their passports are taken. And the moment they get in, they're not only are they not paid, but they're tortured by the members of the royal family, if you will, that brings them in. I mean, literally tortured.
I read the Arabic news, not the English news, not the American news, the Arabic news, the ones who hate the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They rape them. They use them as sex slaves plus being slaves.
Yeah, and
why is everybody shocked all of a sudden? I don't get it.
Doesn't the Quran condone rape and telling Muslims that they have the right to do whatever they want to with their slaves, and that sex with a slave is appropriate in Islam? And is rape not forced sex on somebody who is compelled to by force to engage in sex? So doesn't the Quran actually endorse rape?
100% it endorses rape, especially of those who are not Muslim. Guaranteed. It's in the Quran. It's not negotiable. Why everybody is surprised all of a sudden?
Shouldn't we be concerned that in the case of Qatar, isn't Qatar the largest weapons supplier to the Mujahideen fighting against Assad in Syria? And weren't they the largest weapons supplier of the jihadists that toppled the government in Libya?
Yes, and they are at the same time protected by the United States of America.
Yeah. There isn't the emir of Qatar also the is he the founder of Al Jazeera Network?
He owns it.
So he's got a propaganda arm in Al Jazeera, and in addition to that, he's the primary weapons supplier to jihadists worldwide.
Correct.
And this is a guy whose personal fiefdom now tortures and enslaves those that it has brought in to do the work that its own citizens are unwilling and incapable of doing.
We must add, it's 1.2 million workers. 1.2 million workers, and they will need another million to finish the job that they need to do by 2022.
Stunning.
We're not talking about few numbers. We're talking about gigantic numbers.
And the only productivity, the only value that exists in Qatar is that the emir, recognizing that his oil was running out and realizing that most of the natural gas was just burned off as a nuisance, there had Europeans and Americans build the world's largest natural gas processing plant that was able to turn natural gas into, and I think it's to a liquid form that could be under pressure and under temperature reduction could be shipped to various countries around the world, particularly to Europe, and that he has made his fortune by this process. Is that correct?
That is correct. But what is amazing is that people are so stupid that they have been watching and reading and nothing registers in their brain. Everything that registers in their brain is like watching Big Brother.
Yeah.
That registers in their brain.
So
but
it's
the destruction of Christians all over the Muslim world, nothing happens.
Yeah. So the weapons that are being
people, nothing happens.
So the weapons that are being deployed in Syria to wipe out the Christian population were actually supplied by the emir of Qatar. Yeah.
Yes, but with the help of America.
Yeah, because we supplied the weapons. He bought the weapons from America, correct?
Yeah, but he's protected also. Qatar has got one of the biggest facilities of American Navy, if I remember correctly.
Yes, correct. It's the Navy's largest port facilities in that part of the world are in
So Qatar. What do we have here? The very people who hate America, the very people who are undermining America and every other human being who's not a Muslim, is protected by American arms.
Yeah, it is. We're on the wrong side. Turn to another place in the world. Can you explain why you think this occurred? Yesterday, a variety of Islamic militants from Pakistan put on Indian Army uniforms in the Kashmir area and then went off and killed nine people, some civilians, some Indian military. Why, since Pakistan broke away from India following Gandhi's successful peaceful revolt against the British Empire, when India got its independence, and Pakistan broke away because the Muslims didn't want to be in a shared power system with the Hindus, why now continue to fight? Why did these Muslims think that it was appropriate to dress up as Indians and go kill them?
Because as far as the Muslims are concerned, the Hindus are subhuman. Look, Pakistan and India became two states in 1947-48. India continued to be a democracy. Pakistan will never be a democracy. And yet, no human being in America that I know of figures out why. Why is India, which is 1,000.2 million people, is a democracy, and Pakistan is not a democracy? Well, it's because Pakistan is Islamic, and Islam cannot tolerate democracy. Why is it so difficult for people to understand these simple things?
It's true, and if you were to break the Islamic world down at the moment, that the Saudi Arabians are the primary supplier of mosques for fundamentalist Muslims around the world, and therefore they fuel the ideology of Islamic Jihad, and that the Qataris are the primary weapon suppliers for Islamic Jihad, and the Pakistanis are the primary state sponsor of terrorist organizations. There's more terrorist organizations, Islamic terrorist organizations, sponsored by the Pakistani government than any other nation on earth. Are those three statements true? So you've got the weapon supplier, the Mujahideen supplier, and the mosque ideology supplier amongst those three countries.
And these are only three out of 57.
But
I'm not counting the other remaining 54.
But would my statement be reasonably accurate that if you were to say, of the 57, that the primary sponsor of mosques and therefore of fundamentalist Islamic jihadi ideology is Saudi Arabia? And that
100%.
Okay, and that the primary supplier of weapons now for jihadists worldwide is Qatar.
Correct.
And the one nation among the 57 that is the most prone to establish its own Islamic terrorist organizations for its own purpose, like, for example, the Taliban, is Pakistan.
Correct. And yet, the American government that you have, and even the previous American government, they are comatose. They're completely dead. Brain dead. I'm not kidding with you.
Now,
go on.
No, I just want to make one conclusion here. You've already made it. I'd just like to reinforce it. So those are the three worst Islamic countries in the world in terms of jihadi ideology, jihadi weapons, and the jihadi organizations themselves. Are those not the three nations in the Islamic world that the United States is closest to?
Of course. Yes. This is the enigma. This is the dichotomy. Here you have America trying to say, and all the time saying, we are going to go against terrorism, we're going to stop terrorism, we're going to stop jihad. You can't. You're protecting them. You are nurturing them.
Right. We're paying
How
for them.
How are you going to destroy them?
Yeah, we're paying for them. We are we're uplifting them. We're protecting them. We are arming them. All of those things. A related item in the news, IQ, is that Syrians, by the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions, are fleeing the civil war in Syria that America started, that the Qataris are fueling with their weapons, and that the Saudi Arabians are funding with their money. War has caused hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of refugees. When the refugees in a war now that Qatar, the United States, and Saudi Arabia started, leave and they go into a country like Syria and Turkey. Are the Syrians, are the Yemenis and the Saudi Arabians and the Jordanians and the Turks, are they embracing of these people? Are they doing anything to help them?
They don't. Arabs never help another Muslim country. Arabs never help another Arab country. Arabs, with all their wealth, never help the Palestinians. You know what? The Arabs alone could have created Palestine and made it better than Israel. Do you know who supports the Palestinians? Americans and the West.
Yeah, that's true. We'll return to Shattering Myths with IQ Al-Rasuli and talk about this problem in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have a few more minutes with IQ Al-Rasuli this morning. IQ, this really sounds amazing to me, that here you have a civil war in Syria that is started by the United States because of our invasion of Iraq, that is funded by the Saudi Arabians, that is weaponized by the Qataris, and have millions of refugees now. They say that there's a quarter of a million refugees in Yemen, which is on the far side of Saudi Arabia. How is it possible that you could have these refugees begging in the streets with Saudi Arabia, with this enormous amount of land, most of which is completely unoccupied, with all the wealth in the world? Why aren't the Saudi Arabians, who are funding this war, providing some relief for the people that they claim that they're arming jihadists on behalf of?
Why isn't anybody, or why hasn't anybody asked the same question 60 years ago regarding the Palestinians?
Yeah, why? It's the exact same question.
The Arabs who created the Palestinian issue, they invaded Israel, they lost the war, the Palestinians paid the price, and they never helped them. Never. Only America. By the way, hundreds of billions of dollars. We're not talking about billions of dollars. In 65 years, hundreds of billions of dollars from America, from Europe, were spent on the Palestinians.
Now, that's not to say that the mythical people known as the Palestinian, because there really is no such thing as a Palestinian, they're just Arab Muslims. That's not to say that the Saudi Arabians and the Kuwaitis and the Qataris don't provide something to them. They do. Weapons.
Thank you.
That's really all they provide to them is weapons. But Why is it with, for example, this is a related issue. Why is it then with the mythical people that call themselves the Palestinians, Arab Muslims, with Saudi Arabia having, you know, millions of square miles of land available, and some of the land, you know, right there on the Gulf of Aqaba. I mean, some pretty nice pieces of land, huge swaths along the Red Sea. Why don't they establish a community? They could build, in fact, Egypt and the Sinai. Why don't they spread the people out, use the wealth of OPEC to build communities for these people? Or they really have no interest in those people. It's just that they exist as a thorn in Israel's side, and if they continue to have a miserable existence, they can continue to use them as a thorn in Israel's side.
That's exactly what you just said. I mean, I don't have to answer it. You said it. The only purpose of the, and this is the Palestinians, the way they are in camps, is because the Arabs and the Muslims use it against America, against the conscience of Europe, and against Israel. Why is Europe guilty? Why are the Americans guilty? The Arabs who created the Palestinian issue. There was a two-state solution in 1947. There was. Now you're talking about it 65 years later, and Kerry wants to create another Palestinian state. But there was a two-state solution. The Jews accepted. The Arabs refused. They wanted to exterminate the Jews. They lost the war.
Right. And every subsequent war since then.
Europe, mostly Christian people, who have been paying for the survival of the Palestinians, who are destroying Christian people.
Sorry. In fact, the same thing is true in the lands controlled by the Palestinian Authority, the PA, that we have witnessed in your country, in Iraq, whereas Islam is given autonomy over those regions, the Christians have been annihilated. It used to be 20% Christian population in places like Bethlehem and in communities that are now controlled by the Palestinian Authority, and that number now is a fraction of 1%.
And
why don't you tell our what happened in your country, in Iraq, following the American invasion?
1.3 million in 2003, less than 200,000 today.
It's an annihilation. It's genocide.
It's genocide.
Right.
It is blatant genocide, and nobody calls it genocide.
What happened about a month ago in the Syrian civil war? Once the Saudi Arabians decided that the Sunnis that they were arming were losing, and they hugely increased the quality and quantity of their weapons, so that they had anti-aircraft and anti-tank and anti-personnel weapons, what was the first community assaulted in Syria once the Mujahideen there were more aggressively armed by the Qataris and the Saudis?
Christian. It was a Christian community. It was a Christian village.
Yes, and what they did is said, you'll either convert to Islam or we will cut off your head, correct?
That's exactly what they did.
And what was the first thing that the Muslims in Egypt did once they gained control of power in Egypt? What was the first community they attacked?
The destruction of the Coptic Christians.
And who funds the Egyptians' ability to do that?
America.
Yeah. We are part of the problem. We are not part of the solution. Yep.
I will see IQ. You, God willing, next week.
Thank you, and IQ has another interview to do at this time. Godspeed. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Larry having called in from Florida. Welcome back, Larry. I've got an email that was sent to me about the Kenyan hostage taking. I guess upwards of 100 people were killed and several hundred people were mutilated by Muslims from Somalia that I decided that would be a good thing to do on behalf of their religion. They had a quiz that they asked the captives to determine whether or not they were Muslims, because there would be a different treatment if they were Muslims versus if they were not Muslims. Now, why do you think that these militants from Somalia would be asking whether or not someone was a Muslim if they were not, in fact, perpetrating this armed assault in the name of Islam?
They wouldn't.
No.
I mean, that's...
So does one really have to have an investigation to figure out who did this when the group that did it claimed credit for it, and that their means of determining whether a hostage was killed or mutilated or set free was whether or not they could ask a question, answer a question to prove whether or not they were Muslim. The question happened to be, what was the name of Muhammad's mother?
Well, you know what? I've got a friend that's a journalist in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And she had told me some months ago that the Obama administration paid to have the Kenyan Constitution rewritten. That's who funded it. It was headed up by none other than the scumbag Desmond Tutu. And part of that Constitution now states that you can't say anything negative about Islam or it's considered a hate crime and is punishable. Did you know that?
Well, there's a lot of countries around the world where the Constitution has been rewritten or the laws have been established that says that that speaking ill of a religion is a hate crime and it's punishable.
This was specifically Islam, and it was funded by the Obama administration. Now,
yeah.
Why on earth
yeah.
would taxpayers in the United States be concerned with constitutions being written in Kenya? I'm flabbergasted here.
Yeah, one of the things that is the case in most of these is that they do not specifically mention a religion. But there's only one religion that lashes out violently when it is criticized. And, by the way, truth is not an alibi. If you're doing what I do, which is to expose Islam based upon the Islamic scriptures, so to use the words of Muhammad's and the deed of Muhammad and the creation of Islam, telling the truth is not a defense. Now, and the reason that most of the time they don't specifically say that it's you can't speak against Islam is that by saying that you can't incite religious hatred, you can't speak out against any religion, they are more clandestinely establishing rules around the world that preclude people from exposing the truth of their religion. There's only one religion that the truth is absolutely universally lethal true. There isn't any justification for Islam. I mean, Muhammad was the most repulsive man who ever lived. And so Muslims are trying to impose those rules around the world so that the truth cannot be known, and that's the one thing that is lethal to them. You know, if you want to stop Islamic terrorism, tell the truth about Islam. By the way, the answer to the question is Amina. And the reason that that is interesting is that Amina was born into the Quraysh tribe. And the Quraysh tribe claimed to be a descendant of Ibrahim, not Abraham, but Ibrahim, through his son Ishmael. I think, if I recall, Yahweh's one of his very earliest prophecies was about the descendants of Ishmael, which are now claimed by this religion to be Muslims. What did he say about Ishmael's descendants?
His hand, he'll be a wild ass of a man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. That's what it's
It's a little more specific. He actually a little more specific than that because it depicts what we're witnessing right now in Syria, what we're depicting, what we're witnessing in Iraq, what we're witnessing in Egypt. He did say that that his descendants will be wild asses of men, but he said his hand will be raised against his brother, and his brother's hand will be raised against him, and he will live in hostility with the whole world. And the reason that that's important is that Islam is the only religion worldwide now where they're savaging one another. Muslims are killing Muslims in astonishing numbers around the world. You know, Larry, you and I, when we began this together, we often wondered how in the world, as depraved as the world is now, as delusional as the world is now, how in the world were we going to make it to 2026 or 2027, which is the starting point of the Magog War, which is the all-Islamic assault against Israel? How are we going to make it that far before, you know, it seemed like that was way too far away as fast as the world was disintegrating. But we have found the throttling mechanism. The throttling mechanism that is thwarting Islam's ability to launch World War III against Israel is their hatred for one another. It's their hand being raised against their brother and their brother's hands being raised against them.
Yeah, if they put all their effort into just wiping out Israel, they might have an easier time of it, you know.
Yes, but right now they're spending more time trying to kill one another than doing anything else. The news out of Syria is quite interesting. Were you aware that the United Nations announced today that there are 7 chemical weapons attacks that they have not been publicly disclosed to the world, 3 of which have happened after the 21 of August Damascus attack that sparked the threats from the United States. So there have been 3 additional gas attacks and sarin gas in Syria since the August 21st attack, and 4 prior to it.
Yeah. When they got caught with their pants down lying, they might stop. You mean they're continuing? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Khan el-Assad. Yeah. Khan el-Assad on the 19th of March. That's the one that the United Nations investigated, as did the Russians, and both came to the same conclusion that the sarin attack was perpetrated by the rebels. Then there's Sheikh Massoud on the 13th of April. There's Sarakoub on the 29th of April. There's Ghouta on the 21st of August. That's the one that the United States and Europe all claim that was perpetrated by Assad, even though all evidence is to the contrary. And then you have Baharia on the Baharia took place on the next day. Yeah, my video is actually showing them shooting the projectiles.
Posted before the world knew it.
That's correct. Posted before the world knew it. But taken down by the United States government. Baharia on the 22nd of August, the following day. Jobar on the 24th of August. And Ashurfia on the 25th of August. All chemical assaults. And not a word about a red line here. Nothing else to be said. It is so obvious that the rebels gassed their own people for the express purpose of encouraging the United States to send them more weapons, which we're doing, and to bomb Damascus, engaging in the war that they were losing. Larry, we have Jason calling in from Toronto, who wants to add to the story of peaceful Muslims asking or acting lovingly towards the world. Hello, Jason. Welcome back to the program.
Yeah, hi. I remember I saw a video a while ago, and it was a Copt priest, and he was talking about Islam, and he spoke about how, you know, the Copts, the Egyptian Christians and whatnot, living among the Muslims and experiencing being, you know, eventually overtaken and abused and whatnot. And he mentioned that the two faces of Muslims, the Mecca face, he called it, and the Medina face. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that because, you know, like, I've worked beside Muslims and, you know, it's, I remember the one guy I spoke to, he mentioned, like, he didn't like music, and I didn't really catch on to that at first, but after I learned more about Muhammad, I saw where it was going, and you got to wonder, like, you know, if these guys are given the opportunity, what makes you think if they're learning that they're superior and that they're victims, you know, every single Friday, what makes you think that they're not going to take that opportunity? You know, I'm not speaking directly, but...
Let me speak of the two different faces, and then we'll speak about what is likely to occur. The two faces are when most of the Quran was revealed in Mecca, and during a time that Muhammad got fewer than 70 converts to his new religion. He just was not credible. And he had no ability to fight anyone. And so in Mecca, all you have is animosity. I call it the never-ending argument. Most of the Meccan verses are the Quraysh tribe telling Muhammad that you're demon-possessed, you're a lying fool, that you're an absolute scum of a person, and that you're not speaking for God, and that you have absolutely no credibility. And then Muhammad claims in his Quran that Allah responded by saying that the Quraysh were lying and they had no rights, and that that he was personally going to attend to their torture in hell, and then describes those tortures. But there is actually no violence. There's just threats of future violence in hell. That's the Mecca face. Muhammad then was booted out of Mecca in shame following the satanic verses and following his imaginary wild-ass rides to Jerusalem. The combination of those things got him thrown out of Mecca as a laughingstock. And on the way to Yathrib, today's Medina, which is the Medina face, he met with some residents of Medina, Yathrib in the day, and they pledged to wage war against all humankind. It's called the Pledge of Aqaba. The first thing we read about Muhammad's trip up to Yathrib, today's Medina, is this commitment of the communities in Yathrib, today's Medina, to wage war against all humankind on behalf of Muhammad. Every Quran surah that is then revealed in Yathrib, today's Medina, focuses on one of two things, and the subject completely changes. It's one of two things. It's either focusing expressly on jihad and using weapons to terrorize everyone who isn't a Muslim, or it's focused on creating hatred between initially the Jews so that they become easier prey, and then once they've been overhunted on the Christians. So the Yathrib Medina face of Islam is the face of terrorism, where the Meccan face of Islam is one of rage and animosity that leads to terrorism. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to the last segment of Shattering Myths for today. We have Jason and Larry both on the line. Jason brought up a point of wondering if there was a triggering mechanism perhaps that would transition the Muslims that he is working with from being reasonably peaceful to being jihadist, and what the two faces of Islam represent. And we address the Mecca and Medina face of Islam. Mecca is I'm a victim and I'm enraged because I'm being victimized, and Medina is my response to being victimized and being enraged is I'm going to inflict terrorism against all humankind. That is the transition in those two faces. And so what is it that causes a Muslim to go between one and the other? Happened to have a story that I was going to talk about in this segment. It's about a story about Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab was the perpetrator of the heinous assault against the Kenyans in that marketplace. It means that the lads, or the youth in Arabic. The average age of an Al-Shabaab jihadist is 15. They are lured into this based upon two things. One is they're offered a piece of fruit. Their conditions are so impoverished that a piece of fruit each day is sufficient for them to pick up a gun and kill others with the weapon. And they are shown routinely pictures like the Bollywood pictures that are produced in India of pretty girls dancing and singing and the like. They're shown movies of that, and they're told that these movies were shot by other mujahideen just like them, who had been killed fighting the opponents, and that they had sent these movies back. Now, why they were written, and produced
natural messengers.
Yeah, and why they were speaking I forgot what the language is of in India, but that they were, not speaking Arabic. But nonetheless, they were brought back by a supernatural messenger to show them what the brothel that Allah had prepared for them was like, where they would have their 72 virgins. And so the only thing that was required to take a boy that was, grown up in the culture of Islam into a jihadist willing to shoot and kill innocent people was a piece of fruit and a film promise of you're going to have virgins in paradise. It really is the gang mentality that we witness in so many other situations where young boys and girls, apart from a gang, wouldn't go and spray bullets into a park. But as part of a gang, they'll do so, as we witnessed here in Chicago about a week ago. And so The only thing about those who you are working with that are claimed to be Muslims is that, you know, they're going through the motions. They're probably bad Muslims. They probably know very little about Muhammad and who he really was, or the fact that Muhammad was a terrorist. And, you know, they're just going to kind of go about their lives unless they're in the kind of environment where the survival instinct kicks in. You're told, you know, I'll feed you if you pick up a gun, and as part of the group mentality, the gang mentality, let's go off and be jihadists so that we can earn express tickets to Allah's paradise. It's a very small trigger that needs to be pulled to transition from enraged victim to jihadist warrior, the two faces of Islam. Does that help answer the question, Jason?
Yeah, I would only add that maybe it would be just the opportunity to complete their ambitions. So, you know, yes. If they ever had the opportunity to just seize power and, you know, yeah. Like, if there was a majority of them, you know, that they wouldn't have to necessarily be in survival, like, be scared of survival, but, you know, they would just, you know, turn on, you know, the people they live with and try to make it all Islamic.
Yeah, let's speak about opportunity. In the 57 Islamic states, they're the hellholes of the world. They're violent to a fault. There's no life worth living in any of those countries. So where they are the majority, they have the opportunity to impose Islam, and life becomes a living hell. And then thanks to the United States and to Western Europe, who funds Islamic jihadism, we have enabled them to export their terror-based religion around the world, and we witness the consequence of it every day. Yep.
Thanks.
Opportunity is the only thing that a Muslim lacks, and understand that the Muslims who act out in as terrorists have not corrupted their religion. They're not extremists. They're all fundamentalists. It is impossible to be a good Muslim and not be a terrorist according to the Quran. Larry, Jason, I want to thank both of you for calling in. I want to thank, of course, IQ al-Rasuli for his insights into Islam. It is a religion that we either confront and understand and use our words to explain why it should not be tolerated, or it will destroy everything that we love and everyone that we love. I'm Yada. Look forward to being with you next week.